Occupational Health Surveillance and Chief of the Occupational Health Surveillance and Evaluation Program at the California Department of Public Health. He directs the Worker Tracking and Investigation Program for Work-Related Injuries and Diseases in California. He served on the California Occupational Safety and Health Standards Board and was involved in the promulgation of the standard that we're going to be talking about today. So.
Thank you. So I'm probably just going to highlight a few things that I have on my PowerPoint for sake of time. I have nothing to disclose, no relationships to disclose. I think understanding the California heat illness standard in part is helped by understanding how we got here and then the issues that were debated at the time that the standard passed. And I like to start with what I would call the index case in the field of public health, which was Mr. Valdivia in July of 2004, who was 53, and he was working in 100-degree heat in Kern County, California, and he developed the typical signs of heat illness. And one of the things to emphasize is that the time between symptoms and elevation of dangerous or fatal levels of core body temperature can be a matter of hours, which is why if you're working in a field in the Central Valley of California in the summertime with temperatures over 100 degrees, it's just really critically important to have protections for farm workers. Now, this is also true for workers in construction and uniformed occupations like police and fire, for indoor workers, but it's particularly critical, and this is how the an issue initially came to attention in California, because farm workers are remote, they're out in the fields, and they don't have access to shade, to emergency response. It could be a long distance to get to water, and that's what happened with Mr. Valdivia. And there was some debate about why the paramedics didn't get there, whether they were called to the wrong place or they couldn't find the field where he was working, but you can imagine that if you're out in the Central Valley, it could be hard to figure out which dirt road you have to turn down to get an ambulance there. By the time he got to Kern County Medical Center by his son, by the way, his core temperature was 108, and he was declared dead from heat stroke. Back in 1992, I think, Neil, you might have been with the program then. Neil Meislich is here. With our branch, we actually had a program in which we were tracking work-related injuries and diseases in a couple of counties in California. And we actually had a cantaloupe picker who died of heat stroke, and we put out one of these reports in May of 1992. And I, to be honest with you, I had forgotten about this report until I went back into my files and I found it. And this was the before the internet, and there wasn't a web that I can remember in 1992. So this was never posted. We disseminated it to our reporters This was either Monterey, I think this was in Fresno County. But this was a sort of the proverbial, the way I like to think of a tree falling in a forest. And unfortunately, I don't think there was anybody there to really hear it in 1992. Heat illness, heat stress on the job has been occurring, I have to think, for hundreds if not thousands of years. It's been hot. Workers have been in oppressive working conditions for a very long time. But what makes this moment different was the United Farm Workers campaign that started in 2005. And one of the really signature parts of this campaign was really the ability to publicize, to get legislative support for these tragedies that occurred out in the field. And Mr. Valdivia's son, who had brought him to the Kern County Medical Center, testified in our Assembly Labor Committee in March of 2005. And it very quickly passed the Assembly, followed by what was called the Meeting in the Sun, which got widespread press attention, which I thought was a really very, very brilliant piece of sort of bringing the attention of these cases to the media in the middle of a field when it was very hot, sitting on the back of a pickup truck. You can see the symbolism by the gravestones, the faux gravestones, the example of a pop-up tent on the right, which could be purchased at, a Target for $50, $100 and popped up to provide some shade for workers, along with, a 5 or 10 gallon igloo. And so you look at this and you say that we actually, in fact, take better care of animals in California. There was more concern when we had a couple of heat waves about the tens of thousands of cattle that died than there were about the farm workers that died, until this UFW campaign that was then followed by 4 additional tragic deaths in July of 2005. And this was the first time that I can remember that the governor of California, or perhaps governors in general throughout the country, stepped up and said, this is a tragedy and we're going to do everything it takes to prevent this from ever happening again. And in the most unbelievable record time, we had emergency regulations for heat illness in August of 2005. I mean, this is, between May, June, July, August, three or four months, we had emergency regs. And that was followed by a Cal-OSHA review. Amalia, as a co-author, is going to follow me. Took a look at these cases that were investigated by the health department and by Cal-OSHA. I thought there were a couple of interesting points that you found, Amalia, and that was that there was dehydration in the majority of these cases, but there was water apparently available, and there was also shade. So the issue was, in many of these most tragic cases, really the ability to request and take breaks and ask for and have the control over the job pace and the working conditions to be able to even have access to these basic necessities. So we passed this new standard. We had an emergency standard. A year later, we had a permanent standard that took effect in July of 2006, and it has three, as you probably hear to follow, three essential elements to that standard, actually four. I like to say it's the four horsemen or whatever. One is breaks, and these were called preventive recovery periods. I don't know if any speakers will talk more about this, but it allows for the worker to ask whenever he or she thinks it's necessary for a quote-unquote preventive recovery period. In common parlance, it's a break, right? It's a rest break. That's what you and I would probably think of it as. But it's explicitly called a preventive recovery period because a rest break, and maybe others in the audience would chime in, triggers wage and hour standards. And rest breaks then get over into who pays for those breaks. As you know, that there's breaks that are required twice a day for 15 minutes and a half hour for lunch under wage and hour laws. It's only 5 minutes, and these are, clearly, let me just go back, clearly inadequate for working in 100 degrees, but it was a compromise. It requires water, and it requires at least a quart an hour or 2 gallons per day. And it requires shade. You can see the example of a popped-up tent. And finally, the fourth is required training of both supervisors and workers. It missed a couple of really key essential elements that were debated but did not get in. One is some kind of a trigger. So the idea that one actually would have to go measure something in the environment, like temperature, or maybe heat index, which is a combination of temperature and humidity. But even in California, where it's not very humid, generally, just measuring the temperature. And it also missed the work break cycle, the 5 minute, which was not adequate. I'm going to skip over some of the physiology of heat illness. Suffice it to say that it's very well recognized among military recruits, athletes, and among certain worker populations. But also suffice it to say, it's not terribly well studied. I'm going to skip ahead and highlight just one other point, a couple of other points here. There is an ACGIH standard. That's the American Conference of Government Industrial Hygienists. They're the voluntary organization that sets threshold limit values. They have a really excellent threshold limit value for heat stress. Tom Bernard, who's a professor in Florida, was the primary author or chair of the committee. And if you take a look at this, it is divided up by workload, light, moderate, and heavy on the top axis. And then on the left, you can see the work rest cycles, and then you can see the different temperatures. So if just take for an example, if you're doing heavy work, this is ACGIH. Not the California. This is ACGIH. This is voluntary standards. You can just take as an example the lower right-hand corner. You can see that if it's 86 degrees Fahrenheit or 30 degrees centigrade, and you're doing heavy work, which is, giving the examples of the ACGIH, heavy is shoveling dry sand and cutting with a handsaw. That's the examples that are given by the ACGIH. You should be on a work rest cycle of, in the lower left-hand corner, 25% work and 75% rest. So just now imagine that you're working in, you know, Kern County or Bakersfield in the summer, and you're doing heavy work. So the question then came up when I was on the standards board, what is heavy agricultural work? How does that relate to shoveling dry sand or cutting with a handsaw? And this is where I guess I'm inviting those of you who are interested in more research and filling in some of the data gaps we have is to actually do some basic physiological assessment of farm work. Because I could not really find out, except by talking to Tom Bernard on the phone and asking him, Tom, where do we plug agricultural work into your guidelines? He said, it's probably moderate, you know, based on what I know that farm workers do. But in fact, the physiological measurements, as far as I could tell from reading the literature, have never been done in agricultural workers, which is very interesting. And there are some non-invasive methods I think we could use to assess the physiology of farm work. So we don't follow this ACGIH in California. We follow a different standard that's a five-minute break. We added a trigger. We modified the standard and added an 85 or a 90-degree trigger? 85-degree trigger for the shade. 85-degree for shade, and what is it, 90 degrees for some other stuff? Yeah. This is followed by the U.S. military, which is interesting. And so here's an example of just a random example I pulled off the website of the Naval Region Mid-Atlantic Amphibious Base Safety Office. And the military actually has terrific heat illness practice. And they have wet bulb globe temperature. They assign people to go out on basic training to measure the heat and to make sure the recruits have adequate rest breaks. And of interest, it was also followed very carefully during the Gulf oil spill and when Fed OSHA and NIOSH monitored the health of the workers and they were monitoring them in their Tyvek suits during the cleanup on the beach. This was followed. And they had almost no heat illness, the very few heat illness cases, which I think was a tremendous success. If they really did follow this, and I never was actually able to confirm, but I believe they actually, this was really pretty closely followed. We collected some data, and I'm sorry, this doesn't show up. I don't know what happened to the X and Y axis. But you can use your imagination, and what do you guess is the peak there? These are the heat illness cases from our workers' comp data. That was 2006. And basically, what we showed was that cases peak over the summer months, not surprisingly, but what I also thought was interesting was that there are cases, and the heat-related illness claims are in black, and all claims are in gray. There are cases that occur year-round. And this was important input because we discussed whether or not there should be a monthly trigger to our standard. And I think Washington State does have a monthly, you know, the standard only takes effect during certain months in Washington State. In California, it's year-round. It's a 24/7, 365-day standard. We looked at differential rates by Hispanic, non-Hispanic. And I apologize, it's small. But the takeaway is that the rates were the same, which surprised us. Now, this was derived from workers' comp data. And I think it reflects a tremendous underreporting, differential underreporting. Yeah.
I remember
Yeah. No, that peak was in 2006. That was the last major heat wave I think we did have here that was really prolonged. There is data from Paul English, yes? Yeah, who looked at the total community, Paul English looked at the total environmental impact. Neil, did you want to? Yeah. Yeah, there is some really good data on our heat wave deaths and the impact of the heat waves in California on the general community, not just the worker deaths. So I want to end, because Kevin's giving me the high sign, needs to be my final suggestion, is that we make occupational health a part of every climate change initiative, and we really need to be tracking this data. We have our data set through 2008 using workers' comp data, and for anybody who has a research interest and would like to talk to me afterwards, we have a workers' comp data set that's very robust, that needs to be updated. And I think that would be interesting to do. So thank you. Kevin asked me if we have time for any questions, one or two questions. Yeah. Oh, melanoma. Good question. The question was, if I got you, I didn't hear quite the beginning of it, but is there interest, or are we tracking or concerned about melanoma? Oh, developing melanoma related to heat exposure, UV. I don't have any data on, does anybody have data on melanoma in farm workers relative to heat exposure? I don't, it's a good question. I don't have the answer. Yeah. Is there occupational data? Is there differential, is there, huh? I guess I would ask my colleagues at Follow whether we're incorporating the melanoma message, the sun protection message, and how that relates to the heat illness education that we're doing. I don't have any of the sort of the cancer data. We do have a very robust cancer registry in California. I just am not familiar with whether we've looked at farm workers or outdoor workers in general.